So apropos of what Lisa said, and because Vicki is not here today, Vicki, Director of Adult Enrichment, and my wife, I can say that for the second year in a row, Vicki is voluntarily returning to the church $5,000 from her salary. So she is taking a $5,000 salary reduction, which means in 2 years she has redonated to the church $10,000. That's her decision. But since we pool our funds, I have to say it does have an impact, but it's a decision gladly made once she made it, gladly made. But it's a decision that I'm proud of. It shows, I think, to us, and we want to share with you, that this church means a great deal to us, sometimes more than words can say. And there are ways in which we can signify that and show that. So, I will get in a little bit of trouble for saying that, but Vicki's not here, so we'll just keep it amongst ourselves, right? So let me just say that the views and attitudes expressed in this sermon do not reflect in any way the attitudes of William Sly, who bid upon and won the right to choose the subject matter the sermon seeks to address. Bill bid upon that subject matter for the sermon in last November's goods and services auction. His questions and concerns weren't complicated, but they were challenging and important, and they address issues which I have never comfortably resolved in now 40 years as a Unitarian Universalist minister. Knowing a sermon title to be a requirement for clarity, I chose Who is Welcome Here, sensing it was broad enough in scope to speak to Bill's concerns and to my own. Fortunately, I have, after much research and investigation, uncovered an answer to the question I posed: who is welcome here? Everybody. So, thank you for coming, and I believe I have discharged my obligation. But because you're empiricists, I know you want to know on what I base my answer. I base it on this little book, Welcome, a Unitarian Universalist Primer. This is published by the Unitarian Universalist Association, 2009, and here's what it says on page 7 and 8. All are welcome. Although many Unitarian Universalists were born in this faith, many more came to it later in life. All are welcome. Our Unitarian heritage calls us to recognize the inherent good of all persons. Well, no, actually not. The principle that they're referring to asks us to recognize the inherent worth and dignity of all persons, but let's not quibble. The Universalist part of our tradition encourages us to extend love and acceptance to all people. You know, I would think that a religious institution might do a little better than encourages us. We encourage you to believe in the golden rule. We encourage you to think that we ought to be loving and kind to one another. But oh well, let's not quibble. You are welcome in a Unitarian Universalist congregation, whatever your gender identity, sexual orientation, racial identity, or class. Our principles call us to affirm the worth and dignity of every individual, to accept one another, and to foster each other's spiritual growth. Well, so, really not all that hard, except this is an issue that some congregations have been dealing with, not just ours. Well, not actually, we haven't had to deal with this one yet. Suppose a convicted pedophile comes to church and wants to take part in all of the activities and programming in the congregation. Are they welcome? Gender identity. Okay, I'm male, and I'm here to say to anyone who will listen that radical feminists have just about ruined healthy, traditional relationships between normal men and women. a normal red-blooded male, that's my gender identity, and in my household, we know who the boss is. Okay. Okay. Now, you do know that's not me speaking, right? You do know that I'm taking parts. So here's another part. Racial identity. I am white and proud of it. So, do I make my point? I think I have. I can easily think of a number of folks who would not be welcome here. Fortunately, racists and misogynists don't tend to seek us out. We don't attract members of the Klan, skinheads, neo-Nazis, neo-Confederates, or members of the anti-government and heavily armed patriot movement. So let's be clear, not all are welcomed here, nor should they be. But of course, the real practical issues confronting us are more difficult. Are Republicans welcome here? Are libertarians, Boy Scouts, CEOs, employees of corporations, folks who work in the oil and gas industry, people whose concerns about fracking have been put to rest by their reading and study? One individual I spoke to about these issues said this: as a group, you use who claim to be open and accepting have trouble with corporate people. That's my observation and experience based on four different UU congregations. Another person with whom I spoke chuckled about, as he put it, my dark corporate past. So while many of us might be critical of some corporate practices, I can't imagine that any of us would condemn members of our congregation who work for or have worked for an American or foreign corporation. I hope not, because over the years, we've had leaders in our church who have worked for Hewlett-Packard, Woodward Governor, Exxon, Shell Oil, and many others. But we've also had a number of church members who work for the United States government. So let he or she who is without sin cast the first stone. We might well wonder if Unitarian Universalists, sometimes referred to as the Greenpeace of religious groups, practice a certain dogma. Not really religious dogma, because I think we've addressed that, but oddly enough, political dogma. Is there a tipping point at which a faith community moves into a political one? Well, let's ask Roman Catholics and evangelical Christians that same question. The Foothills Unitarian Church has never distributed to its members so-called voter guides, thinly veiled endorsements of candidates supporting positions associated with either a particular faith community or denominational structure. If you've seen the voting guides, and I have, they're very clear. There are a number of positions that are listed. The candidates for office are listed in terms of how they have voted on those issues. And you, as a member of the congregation, are asked to take that with you to your polling place. Faith communities have always taken stands on moral issues. We are called upon to do so by our traditions. Slavery, women's rights, prison reform, economic injustice, the one thing we are expressly forbidden to do to preserve our tax-exempt status is to engage in partisan politics as an expression and extension of our faith. And yet thousands of faith communities do that every year through voter guides, sermons, and public statements by priests, bishops, and other clergy. If the question is fair for us to answer about politics, the question is fair applied to every faith community in the United States. It's come up several times in my tenure here, questions such as, how comfortable would Republicans be here? Political conservatives. Conversely, how comfortable would liberal Democrats be at the Timberline Church or Faith Evangelical Free Church on Shields? If the question is fair for us, it's a fair question for other communities as well. So, I attend a few services at a local evangelical church, and then, do I write to the pastor and say that I was a bit uncomfortable with what I sensed were the social values of the community as translated into political sentiments? Do I write a letter to a Mormon church and say that, as a dedicated advocate of same-sex marriage, I was a bit unhappy with their views on the matter? Perhaps I should write to the Pope and ask him to tone down his anti-abortion message because it strikes me as too political. Well, I think you see what I'm trying to say. By reversing some of the questions, it's fair for every faith community to ask where it stands on political issues. But I would say that the space between the political and the deep value and principle beliefs of a community intersect. The only thing is, they're not supposed to intersect in partisan politics. Our core values and principles have analogs in faith and politics. Just as the Church of England was once called the Conservative Party at prayer, the Republican Party in 2013 looks a lot like evangelical Christians doing politics. Unitarian Universalists as a denomination have supported same-sex marriage since the 1970s. We've advocated for reasonable gun control and humane immigration reform. We oppose prayer in schools, and we also oppose indifference to growing economic disparity. We generally support health care reform, with many of us advocating a single-payer system. We've been advocates for abortion rights for women for decades. These made manifest through resolutions at our General Assemblies held annually. While a Nelson Rockefeller Republican or even a Ronald Reagan Republican could, I think, feel comfortable among us, many contemporary Republicans would not. And I think that lack of comfort has less to do with our being more political than it has to do with the Republican Party being more religious, and religious along particular lines. Is it our obligation as a faith community to make everyone feel welcome and comfortable here? I would think the answer could not possibly be yes. Just as I think the same question posed to a Roman Catholic church or an evangelical church would find the same answer. Your job as a faith community is not to make comfortable everybody who enters your doors. That's why we have religious freedom in America, so people can make choices. But pride, as they say, often goes before a fall. And Unitarian Universalists have been too prideful, I believe, about being open and welcoming to all. All? Were we really serious? I don't see how we could have been, and yet it made wonderful PR. No single group, and certainly not a particular religious group, is for everybody. But to return to an earlier theme, intentional exclusion is rather different than self-removal due to lack of affinity with. Intentional exclusion. I believe we would intentionally exclude someone who insisted on speaking homophobic language or racist language, but surely we would never say or want to be understood as saying that we intentionally exclude Republicans and political conservatives. And none of us better say that corporate folks need not apply, because for the last 20 years or so, our very denominational existence has been predicated upon the receipt of millions and more millions of dollars coming to us from a bequest of royalties from vast oil and natural gas reserves in the North Sea. Now, at the first service, a number of people were surprised by that, which surprised me because I thought we had been talking about the Veatch Fund for some years. But maybe we've never been talking about it clearly enough. This is the annual report for 2012 of the Veatch Fund, and I would say it does say something about the world we're living in, where it's made to look quite a bit like a comic book. I guess that's what we're reduced to. Everything is now a graphic novel. But when we turn to the back of the book, The Veach Fund distributes monies to a variety of different organizations. The Veach Fund has been set up separate from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation on Long Island. And I'll say more about that in a minute. But here I will say that from a total distribution of $11,600,000 explicitly to Unitarian Universalism, very close to $4 million was given. That doesn't include all the other congregations and all the other movements within our movement, such as civil rights and sustainable communities, social justice infrastructure, making democracy work, economic equity, and fairness. $11,600,000 in 1 year. So where did the money come from? Arthur C. Veach was a geologist. And before those little inconveniences that we called the World Wars, Arthur C. Veach mapped out a series of vast oil and natural gas fields under the North Sea, in the province, really, of Germany. After the wars are over, Arthur C. Veach exercises his rights to the royalties that will accrue to him from these vast oil and natural gas reserves. When he dies, he bequeaths the rights of those royalties based on those concessions to his wife, Carrie. Carrie is approached by the minister, the then minister, of the Unitarian Universalist Society in Plandome, New York. And the relationship that has developed is a loving and supportive one. But Gerald Weary asks Carrie Veach to, upon her death, bequeath all of those reserves to the Unitarian congregation in Plandome, New York. She agrees, which begins this process by which our denomination has received millions and millions of dollars, because in one particular year, the funds accruing amounted to an eight-figure amount. So it's not exaggerating to say that were it not for the bequest of royalties from these natural gas and oil fields, the Unitarian Universalist Association as we know it, and many of our congregations as we know it, would not exist in their present form. Lurking underneath this largely fact-driven discussion are some key issues that I haven't talked about yet: spirituality, philosophy, community, and faith. So let me quickly conclude by turning to no other than the Tory Party at prayer, the Church of England, and its new leader, who took office on the 4th of February of this year. Justin Welby, in his first sermon as Archbishop of Canterbury, and thanks to Vicky for finding this for me because she religiously reads the BBC News, in his first sermon a few months ago, he said, "If we ignore complexity and humanity, we end up unreasonably disappointed with human fallibility." He quotes recent surveys reporting that only 40% of churchgoers are convinced that the new Archbishop of Canterbury can resolve the problems of the Church of England. And then he goes on to say, "I do hope that means the other 60% thought the idea so barking mad they did not answer the question." He knows that no one person can solve the issues of any human community. He urges society to recognize human fallibility, setting people or institutions up to heights where they cannot but fail is mere cruelty. He says the Church of England must show it can manage discord gracefully over issues such as women bishops and gay marriage. He said this was the challenge the Church faced before it could be a sign to the world of peace and reconciliation. I think it's very important that we understand that the battles that are racking the Church of England are so much more difficult than anything we have considered as a congregation. In fact, I can't think of anything that rises to the level of the animosity in the Church of England now as they consider not only the ordination of women, but also the acceptance of same-sex marriage and gay members in their organization. These are issues which we honestly have no issue with. Long ago, back in the 1800s, we ordained a woman to a Universalist congregation. For years, we've supported same-sex marriage. We have the majority of our clergy now as women. But for the Church of England, what the Archbishop says is, it doesn't mean we all agree, it's that we find ways of disagreeing. We need to understand reconciliation within the church as the transformation of destructive conflict, not unanimity. Perhaps we disagree passionately, but loving each other deeply at the same time, gracefully and deeply committed to each other, is the challenge for the church. And it is the challenge if the church is actually going to speak to our society, which is increasingly divided in many ways, here and overseas, on huge issues. I do not envy the Archbishop of Canterbury or anyone in the Church of England today, and I take seriously the conflicts that they are facing. But frankly, we're on a continuum, all of us in a faith community, because there are always issues that divide us. There are always issues over which we disagree. There are things that make us uncomfortable with one another. Between services, I was talking to a woman in our congregation who was talking about, with me, about her family and about how there are certain issues where they just don't talk about them. They're off the table. And you might, in fact, be in families like that too, where there are issues that are simply so contentious that you agree. Yes, you agree to disagree, but you also agree not to bring the subject up. It's a little harder in a faith community to ever say that certain issues are not up for discussion or debate. But what we can say is that we are called upon, as people of faith, as people of religion, as people of a tradition, to try to truly listen to and honor other people, even those with whom we disagree sharply. We can't command it. We can't demand it. But we can honor it and, yes, encourage it and speak to it as our higher calling and maybe our highest calling. Because when we are here in a place called a sanctuary, then it ought to be a sanctuary from some of the most virulent kinds of statements of hatred and abuse that we hear every day. There should be some place where we can come, where we know that we will be heard and at least respected, if not agreed with, whatever we believe. It doesn't mean it's easy, and it doesn't mean that we always succeed. In fact, it means that we fail. We are not always nice to each other. We are not always willing to honor one another. Our passions, our values, our deepest concerns bring us into conflict with each other. And there are people here who have felt disrespected and not listened to. And that is sad when that happens. Because beyond anything else, we are called upon to be certain kinds of people, the kinds of people not widely known in this society, the kinds of people who we would like to be, people of compassion, caring, able to listen, but able also to be heard, because mutuality asks that the conversation flow both ways. Easy? No. Right? Yes. Let's join together and sing our closing song, The words are printed in our order of service.